VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. Here in the United States, there is violent weather along the Gulf of Mexico coast. Hurricane Barry, now a Category 1 storm, is unleashing heavy rain and maximum sustained winds of 75 miles an hour. It is headed for landfall in Louisiana, with the city of New Orleans in its path. Large areas are without electricity. Some roads are underwater. Two coastal areas south of New Orleans were issued mandatory evacuation orders. The Coast Guard says already it's rescued about a dozen people from their homes. The National Hurricane Center warns that Barry is getting stronger and that there could be a deadly storm surge with wind and rain affecting more than 3 million people across Louisiana and the state of Mississippi. The main threat is flooding in low-lying areas, with special concern for New Orleans, which was devastated by Hurricane Katrina 14 years ago. New deliveries of components for Russia's S-400 air defense missiles are arriving in Turkey, heating up the flashpoint in Ankara's ties with the United States and NATO. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has a report.
The arrival of more parts of the air defense system aboard a fourth Russian cargo plane is occurring despite Washington's objections. The U.S. has repeatedly warned it will impose economic sanctions and kick Turkey out of the F-35 stealth fighter jet program if Ankara does not stop its S-400 purchase. Turkey has refused to bow to American pressure, saying its defense purchase is a matter of national sovereignty. Officials released a statement late Friday saying the procurement was not an option, but rather a necessity due to the nation's security concerns. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Police in Gibraltar say they have released all four crew members of an Iranian tanker without charges after officials detained the vessel last week on suspicion of breaking European sanctions by taking oil to Syria. In a statement, the British Territorial Police said the sailors were freed on bail, but that the investigation was continuing and the ship remains impounded. From Washington, this is VOA News. Officials in Somalia say al-Shabaab militants launched a deadly attack on a hotel in the port city of Kismayo, and some death toll estimates have been as high as 33, with another 56 people wounded. Witnesses say the assailants targeted the building with a car bomb, then stormed inside. The government says among those killed in the attack, two journalists, a UN agency staff member, and a regional election political candidate. Officials in Kismayo also said at least four militants who carried out the assault were shot dead by security forces. More on al-Shabaab from AP's Andrew Meldrum.
Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility. They were pushed out of Mogadishu and other major cities several years ago, but they still maintain a large presence in Somalia in the rural areas, and they carry out frequent suicide bombings and hotel attacks in the capital and now, as we see, in other important cities in Somalia.
That was AP's Andrew Meldrum. Some major sports news today in women's tennis. Seventh-seeded Romanian star Simona Halep has won her first Wimbledon title, defeating Serena Williams in straight sets. Here is AP correspondent Chris Bowers.
Once again, Serena Williams has frozen within reach of a record-equalling 24th Grand Slam singles title. She was taken apart by Simona Halep. The 6-2, 6-2 final decided by a mixture of Halep's trademark consistency and accuracy, allied to good serving, and Williams' inconsistency and uncharacteristic tentativeness. She was love four down in 11 minutes, lost the first set in 26, and despite trying to gee herself up when she hit winners, they were isolated events, whereas the Romanian's phenomenal retrieving kept asking the question. It was all over in 56 minutes, leaving Williams still stranded on 23 majors, and the emotional weight of the 24th seems to get heavier and heavier. Chris Bowers, Wimbledon.
A report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council this week accuses Nicaragua of continuing to abuse human rights defenders and other opponents. Kate Gilmore is the Deputy UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
Our office has received allegations that some of them were subjected to torture or ill treatment by correction officers. We are deeply concerned that human rights defenders and community leaders continue to be targets of attacks, of threats, harassment, and constant surveillance.
This week's report comes a year after Managua's violent crackdown on demonstrations nationwide. Thousands of protesters turned out today in Hong Kong. Things did not go well. Marching along the border with China, the demonstrators were demanding that Chinese traders stop buying goods in Hong Kong, then selling them for a profit on the mainland. The protest ended with police using pepper spray on the crowd. More news at voanews.com. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Nigerians want people that are competent in their work, people that can make a difference and improve the living standards of the people. That's what people are looking forward to.
Nigerians pressure President Muhammadu Buhari for a new cabinet.
Making a blanket statement over what we are saying on radio talk shows, which we believe are issues that affect a common person in this country, is really missing the point.
A major Ugandan opposition party expresses concern about the lack of media freedom.
Section 75 to 80 of the Witchcraft Act of 1889. It doesn't say that we can allow people to do it for 2 minutes or 3 minutes. It criminalizes witchcraft. It doesn't say that maybe for 10 minutes or 20 minutes you can allow people. No, that would have been against that law.
And the government of Eswatini bans a competition between indigenous African doctors and traditional healers. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerians say they expect President Muhammadu Buhari to expedite action to form a new cabinet to help him run the country. Meanwhile, the president says he would only appoint ministers he personally know who are competent as he readies to name a new cabinet. Some analysts, however, say the president should rather empower the civil servants to make decisions to better the lives of Nigerians as he contemplates on naming his ministers. For more, I read Chudi Chukwani, an economist and political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The average Nigerian, majority of Nigerians on the street, don't really care whether the president has a minister or no minister. Because throughout our history, no minister has ever done anything to benefit the common man on the ground. All they have all ended up doing was to add to the misery of the man on the street. And the truth is that we believe if we want to institutionalize and make our institutions work, the president necessarily, the constitution is not mandatory. He doesn't have to appoint ministers. He can work with the council and strengthen the institution of governance, which is the civil servant. We have to really strengthen that machinery of governance. So all this thing about minister is just a show. It's just a way of creating an opportunity for people to come and steal money. Because at the end of the day, most of the corruption and trials that happen in Nigeria is about ministers stealing money and misappropriating funds.
The president is quoted as saying that he will now appoint ministers that he knows. Will this make a difference?
If you want to have to broaden your knowledge, you don't tie yourself by appointing only people that will come there and be singing the same tune as you, the yes men. Nobody will be able to give you a critical and compelling assessment of what to do or bring any new ideas. He has to appoint people even from the opposition party. All he has to look at is the person have the capability and capacity to be able to do something. Why don't you call in people one by one and interview them? Ask them questions. If you want somebody to be your minister of agriculture, call him in. Ask him, what is your idea? How do you think you can turn around the agriculture in Nigeria? Hear from him. See whether it aligns with your vision or whether that person has a vision or not. That is the process in which you now appoint people that will be able to make a difference. Not by telling us the people that you know. You don't call anybody. Then the president is about 70-something years old. Most of the people you know are his age group. So we are going to have a minister of 70-something-year-olds in Nigeria.
Are you therefore saying that expectations for a newly assembled cabinet members who are competent to help run the affairs of the country with the president is low?
Yes. The expectation is that somebody that has the competence and somebody that can make a difference, somebody that can come up with a radical idea that can actually make a difference, be it in infrastructure, be it in transportation, be it in aviation. Look at the kind of rubbish we are hearing in our aviation sector. The foreign airlines are saying that because of safety concerns. They are afraid to fly into our airspace. They are avoiding the airspace. And they say that most of the air traffic controllers are incompetent. Why do you have a bunch of air traffic controllers that are incompetent manning your airspace? What is going on? Nigerians want people that are competent in their work, people that can make a difference and improve the living standards of the people. That's what people are looking forward to.
What about the issue of security? Because the government has said repeatedly that Boko Haram and other militant groups have been technically defeated. There has been an upsurge of militant activities, violence carried out by Boko Haram and ISWAP and all that. What are the expectations there?
You see, the security situation is so bad. Most Nigerians are afraid to even travel from one state to the other for fear of being kidnapped. It is at alarming rate. The number of people that are killed every day in Nigeria because of insecurity problems is at the highest level we have ever seen in the country. So we have a terrible, horrible security situation. And number two, Boko Haram has not been defeated. Every day we get reports hearing that they have overrun one place or the other. They have even attacked military formations to tell you how brazen those so-called terrorists are. And Nigeria is not doing anything meaningful. I remember during the Jonathan administration, the United States Army and the United States government offered to help them. And they turned it down. I remember that the chief of defense of them saying that he knows where the Chibok girls are held, and he knows where they are. And the Americans were asking them, if you know the location, tell us the location. Then go and rescue these girls. Today, over 100 Chibok girls are missing.
Chudi Chukwuani is a Nigerian economist and political analyst. He spoke with me from Abuja. The Cameroonian main opposition party, Social Democratic Front, or SDF, is expressing concerns about a new measure aimed to modify the National Human Rights and Freedom Commission. The party says the new bill will rather empower human rights abusers to conceal evidence. The party contends that the measures should empower human rights groups to visit areas where human rights issues have been reported unannounced in order to ensure their reports reflect the true situation on the ground. For more about their concerns, I reach Senator Henry Kamende Gamsi from the Cameroonian main opposition party, SDF.
Looking at it, we see that it is like a paper tiger. The government has given rights to the commission with one hand and has taken them back with the other. Because you look at Section 11 of the bill, it talks about the impromptu visits which the commission cannot actually effect. That an impromptu visit to a detention establishment could be blocked by the head of that establishment, be it a gendarmerie cell or a gendarmerie brigade or a commissariat, a police commissariat. We now ask the question, why that? Because it is actually like telling the police that it's coming to control the police, somebody is coming to check on wrongdoing to stay away on flimsy grounds, which only he himself will determine whether they hold, and tell you to stay until when he prepares the ground for you to come.
Senator Kamende, the government is of the view, and supporters of the government are saying that the modification of the new human rights bill basically sets the government to meet international standards. What is your take on that?
My problem is not the amendment, which is to align it with the Paris principles of 1993. The Paris principles were adopted internationally. But then the problem is the visit of that commission to areas where human rights are abused, to authorities before authorities where human rights are abused. I need you to go looking at the records of human rights abuses. You will see that out of 5 cases, the government authorities, they do abuse about 3. 3 of the cases is forced within the realm of public authorities or government authorities, be they the uniform officers or be they people in authority. That is what actually happens. So about 3/4, if not 4/5, of human rights abuses are perpetrated by government forces. So if that government power, if that government authority is given the chance to cancel, to destroy all evidence, showing, portraying human rights abuses before the Human Rights Commission can come visit them. Then it is actually giving with the right hand and taking with the left hand. That's what I'm saying. Because it makes us even suspect that the government might not be sincere, might just be doing some of these things just to please the international community and get away with it. After it is adopted, they do different things, because I think that a proper Human Rights Commission is supposed to be, its most powerful weapon is to pay impromptu visits at detention camps, write a word verbatim report of what they have seen at the Declaration of Human Rights.
I've heard some people calling on the international community to pressure the government in order to respect human rights in the country. The government saying that this new bill basically is set to strengthen human rights issues in Cameroon. You are saying they are just playing to the gallery.
Paying impromptu visits? Successfully impromptu visits at human rights abuse center or a detention center where those human rights abuses mostly take place. That is where my concern is. With regard to the other good, I'm not saying that the bill is void of anything, any substance, anything good. But then I consider it dealing with the right hand and taking with the left hand, where the Human Rights Commission is handicapped. They cannot visit, they cannot pay impromptu visits. And then they make the person to whom they are coming to check a judge and a party in his own case, a party and a judge over his own case. You get the point? When a commission coming to visit you has to give you the chance to judge whether the circumstances warrant you to visit him to bring out human rights abuses. He prepares the ground and tells you that no, for this, for security reasons or for circumstances of law, disturbance of law and order or other disturbances or for defense or for this, he judges it and says that no, for security reasons, I don't permit you to visit my establishment today.
So where does the situation of respecting human rights go from here in Cameroon, particularly at the ongoing security crisis in the Anglophone regions, where a lot of accusations have been leveled against the so-called Amber Boys and government forces of abusing the rights of residents in the region?
Well, the thing is, the problem about our country has not been the non-existence of laws or of good laws, but their enforcement. Their enforcement has always been the problem. When they can even criticize what is law, they can change it and make it to look to suit you. But then when it comes to enforcing them, when it comes to putting it into practice, they will do a different thing. And that's where the problem lies. So, in fact, we have seen they are denying all what accusations that are making out of them. On the contrary, they put it on the everything negative they put it. They want to put it on the Amber Boys. But suffice it to say, if Amber Boys could perpetrate the atrocities which they claim they are the ones, which the government claim they are the ones perpetrating, then it means that the government is losing the battle again in favor of the Amber Boys. If Amber Boys could kill in the way the killings are taking place in the northwest and southwest region, if they could burn houses at will, put down villages in their hundreds, burn at will, kill at will, and bring mayhem to bear in the community the way they claim that the Amber Boys are doing it, then the government should be fast to accept that the Amber Boys are in control and that they are actually destroying the country. So they should surrender and we get into negotiations with them, because the destruction of villages, the burning down of houses, the killings, they are very generous. They are very massive, to an extent whereby if one party could actually accuse the other of being the person masterminding all that, then it is indirectly admitting that the other person is so powerful that they cannot control them, and which means it is accepting, the government is accepting defeat in the hands of the Amber Boys. That is, but just to tell that they cannot accept to that is actually defeat. They accuse and they cannot defend when they are accused. They accuse others, but they cannot defend themselves when they are accused.
Henry Kemendi Gamse is an opposition senator from the Cameroonian main opposition party, SDF. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. Ugandan's main opposition forum for democratic change, or FDC, says the government is using state security institutions to undermine media freedom. The opposition party's remark came after accusing the administration of pressuring Alogo FM, an independent radio station, from hosting leaders of the party on its program after the party paid for the airtime. But supporters of the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM, say recent pronouncements by the opposition are meant to create tension which could plunge the country into chaos. To learn more about the opposition party's concerns, I reach Patrick Oboy Amuriat, leader of the Ugandan main opposition party, the FDC.
Yes, indeed. It looks like this is now going to another level because, as has been reported, and that is correct, Mr. Amacha Goli from Aurugo radio station in Adjumani district has now lost his job because of attempting to host us on the radio. And so for us really wanting to speak to the people of the West Nile region, we paid a total of $600 to be hosted for 2 hours. Before that, however, we were informed by the authorities that we could not hold that talk show. When we got to the station at the scheduled time, we found it had been cordoned off by the police and we were ordered to leave. But we insisted that they were violating our rights and would not have any of this. And so we were forcefully evicted using tear gas and bullets by the military and the police.
But Patrick, if the government was concerned for your personal safety after gathering intelligence that they perceived that you would be attacked, isn't it right, as mandated by the Constitution, for the government to protect life and property as well as protect your limbs and save you from being attacked? Isn't this good enough so that after everything calms down, you can go back and be on your show?
I do not think that the government was actually speaking the truth. If they were speaking the truth, then as you said, it is their responsibility to protect lives and properties of the citizens, which is a command given by the Constitution. They should have used whatever means it takes to apprehend these people, stop them doing something that is lawless. By giving that as an excuse, they seem to admit that they are no longer in control of what goes on in their areas of jurisdiction. And so by now, we should have seen action taken against the officers who feigned or who showed incompetence in taking care of our lives. So I think these are mere excuses that were given to stop our show. But more to that, an attack on media freedoms, the journalist who, for no good reason, has had to lose his job just because he attempted to make money for his boss.
Now, some of your critics are saying that some of your statements, yours as well as Chisabesige's, are meant to destabilize the area, create tension in the area, which could create chaos. And that is why the government has to step in to prevent such from happening. What do you say to that?
Well, I think, again, this is a cowardly nature, because if anybody is offended by any statement that we make on radio stations, by virtue of its lack of truth or by virtue of its attempts to incite the public, then they should come out and specifically point out how our statements have a potential to cause instability in the country or in any region, or whether they are not factual. This is what they should be doing. But, you know, making a blanket statement over what we are saying on radio talk shows, which we believe are issues that affect a common person in this country, is really missing the point.
So what happens to your monies? The radio station say they're going to refund your money.
The money would normally be refunded. We have left this with the responsibility with our chapter to do this. But it's really not about the money that is paid to the radio talk show. It takes quite an effort to move 5 hours from the center of from Kampala, the capital city, to this far and very distant part of the country, which is hard to reach. And with that time that is lost, that is not paid for, and our hopes that are dashed, that, you know, cannot be quantified and a value attached to, I think the loss on our part is not quantifiable and no cost can be attached to it. And we believe that even if a cost could be attached to it, it's enormous.
Patrick Oboi-Amuriat is the leader of the Ugandan main opposition party, FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, for a number of years now, there have been horrific stories of Ugandan girls and women being abused and killed in the Middle East. Many who have returned have complained of unpaid wages and abuse. This week, a Ugandan member of parliament, Betty Nambozi, expressed concern about the health of 23 girls who were returned in poor health from Jordan, where they had reportedly been sold into slavery. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached Charles Manguhia Mpaji, bureau chief for the East African, a major newspaper in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, to find out why the issue has gained national attention.
Two reasons explain why it has kind of resurged. One, and I think most important, is that a member of parliament belonging to the opposition, called Betty Nambozi, who represents Mukono municipality in parliament, raised it after she got a complaint from some girls in Middle East. She was able to help them return home, and she described her experience not just in a post on her social media accounts, but also on the floor of parliament, raising fresh debate and concern about Ugandan girls especially being taken to work in the Middle East, where they face unimaginable abuse.
We understand the government has responded to Ms. Nambozi's complaints.
Yes, it has. On the floor of parliament, the minister gave a response and said the government would take action. Government has been promising to take action, but actually has not taken action. That is significant in a way that addresses the plight. What government has done is insist that the girls going to work internationally, especially as domestic workers, should only go if they are sent by a certified and licensed company. And government has argued before and continues to say that some of the girls are going without going through any of the licensed companies. They are being smuggled out by what would be the equivalent of people smugglers who take them across the border into Kenya and then put them on the plane through Kenya. That those are the cases they have seen who are being abused. But government continues to license new companies, and some of the experiences of the victims still say that even those who go through licensed companies face the same abuse.
Talking of those government-licensed companies, there are reports that most of them are owned by well-connected people in government, which means they can't be held to account. How true is that assertion?
We need to check who exactly owns them and check their connection with government. But the fact is that government has seemed extremely reluctant to take action on companies. It hasn't sanctioned any company that has been complained about, and that is significant. Then the business has been growing by leaps and bounds. There are so many companies that have come up recently that are in the business purely of exporting unskilled labor, and particularly the Middle East. And the stories that come out of that is that it's a kind of modern-day slavery. It's a kind of extortion thing because the companies take money from the people they are taking, but they also receive money from the people supposed to be hiring them in the Middle East. And one of the major problems is the moment they arrive on the other side, what we have had, like Nambozi exposed, was that the family was being pressured, of this particular girl was being pressured to pay back $3,000, which they said had been the cost of sending her to work in the Middle East that she was supposed to pay back.
There are also those who claim that government is trying to solve the problem of the high rate of youth unemployment by exporting the youth so that they can't cause trouble back home. Is there some truth to that?
I think there is a significant amount of truth to that kind of statement. Government, faced with a very high unemployment rate, with a very high young population, feels relief when some of those young people can go and find any form of employment outside of the country. It reduces pressure domestically. And secondly, one of the biggest forex earners for this country has been remittances from Ugandans working abroad. Now, some of these are professionals, but the majority are professionals and do many jobs wherever they are. Well, some countries benefit from that. They move ahead to regulate and protect their citizens. The Uganda government hasn't moved in that direction to protect citizens.
Charles Mwanguhia Mpaji is the bureau chief for the East African, a major newspaper in Uganda. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kampala.
More than 1 million Uyghurs, Muslim minority in China, are currently held in Xinjiang internment camps, referred to as concentration camps by human rights organizations and former detainees, while Chinese officials describe them as vocational education centers. Carol Castiel discusses the deplorable treatment of Uyghurs in China. Listen to Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Kingdom of Eswatini has banned a contest between indigenous traditional doctors and healers scheduled for this weekend. Africa Gamma was the organizer of the now cancelled event. He says the competition would have had indigenous African doctors challenging traditional healers. He said a similar event took place during the reign of King Sobhuza II, who died in 1982. But the government issued a statement banning the contest, saying it violates the constitution. For more about the decision to ban the contest, I read Percy Simelani, spokesperson for the government in Mbabani.
As the government of Eswatini, we felt this should be stopped. We're not going to allow a situation whereby something that is against the laws of the land takes place in Manzini. The Witchcraft Act of 1889, section 75 to 80, put it in no uncertain terms that this cannot happen in this country. That law criminalizes witchcraft. So we were not going to allow a situation whereby something that has been criminalized by our own laws takes place in Manzini. So we had to take a position, and we told them it was not going to happen.
So, Percy, but some are arguing that Section 23 of the Eswatini Constitution guarantees freedom of religion, and the ban, they said, undermines the very constitution that guarantees freedom of religion in Eswatini. How do you respond to that?
Section 23 of the Constitution cannot and will not protect any promotion of anything or any freedom that is pegged on criminality. There is no constitution that is going to allow people to practice voodoo sorcery, knowing for sure that it is criminal. So any promotion of any freedom of conscience or any kind of freedom cannot be based on something that is criminal. Once it is pegged on criminality, the constitution and the section that is being quoted cannot protect that particular person.
The organizer, Africa Gamma, is of the view that there is a precedent for this, the reason behind him organizing the event, because he said during King Sobhuza the second time, who died in 1982, there were witch doctors who went against traditional healers under the previous king. So this ban is rather over the top.
King Sobhuza had actually asked doctors and the traditional healers to come out with the best medicine to cure people who were sick. And this particular Gamma, I think, I wasn't there. I hadn't been born by that time. I understand he won because they said someone or some people got healed. It was about healing, not voodoo competition. This particular time, it is voodoo that it is the criminal part of the competition that we don't want. You cannot come to Swaziland and practice voodoo because voodoo is against the spirit of the Witchcraft Act of 1889, section 75 to 80. So we would not have allowed a situation whereby anybody practice what they wanted to practice or state a competition that's against the spirit of that particular section, because that section criminalizes voodoo, sorcery, witchcraft, you name it. So in the case of Sobhuza, Sobhuza had asked a doctors and Inyangas to heal particular people. There was no competition.
I heard some local reports that the government perhaps should have allowed the competition to go on for 10 minutes and probably stopped it. Why didn't the government accept this?
My response to that was, if you were running a mortuary and then a cannibal came to ask for a job to wash the bodies of those people that are brought to your mortuary, would you employ him for 10 minutes or 20 minutes or just refuse to employ him because you don't know what's going to happen to the dead bodies? In the end, the situation whereby even for 10 minutes, these doctors staged this competition. Because even that would have been against the spirit of Section 75 to 80 of the Witchcraft Act of 1889. It doesn't say that we can allow people to do it for 2 minutes or 3 minutes. It criminalizes witchcraft. It doesn't say that maybe for 10 minutes or 20 minutes you can allow people. No, that would have been against that law.
Percy Similani is the spokesperson for the Eswatini government. He spoke with me from Manzini. A court in the Sicilian capital Palermo ruled on Friday that the Eritrean man extradited from Sudan to Italy because he was suspected of being a human trafficking kingpin known as the General was a victim of mistaken identity. For VOA, Sabina Castelfranco has more from the Italian capital, Rome.
Eritrean citizen Medani Tesfamarian Barry was arrested in a coffee shop in Khartoum and extradited from Sudan 3 years ago. Italian authorities believed he was a human trafficking kingpin, but instead the court ruled it was a case of mistaken identity. His defense lawyer, Michele Calantropo, said his client cried with joy when he heard the court decision. Applause broke out in court, and Barry's relatives in the courtroom rejoiced, as did supporters of his innocence outside the court. Calantropo said his client was not the human trafficking mastermind the Italians had sought.
The court verdict says that my client is not the general, and this is the thing that we always sustain since the first time of the arrest of my client. And today we have the confirm about this.
The lawyer added that the Palermo court, however, convicted his client of a lesser charge, that is, aiding two cousins to immigrate to Italy illegally. The sentence was a fine of $112,000 and a 5-year prison term, but given he has spent the last 3 years doing time, it was unlikely he would have to go back behind bars. Calantropo said the court decision would be appealed. From the outset, it had always appeared doubtful that authorities had the right man. During the trial, Barry told the court that Sudanese police had beaten him and stolen his identification document. He always insisted he was not the man they wanted and that he had been a refugee at a camp in Ethiopia. But prosecutors insisted he was the human trafficker and requested he serve a 14-year prison term. Meanwhile, thousands of signatures were gathered on petitions in different countries, including Italy, Britain and Germany, saying Barry was a victim of mistaken identity. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Zimbabweans are suffering from fuel shortages, power cuts and hyperinflation. Compounding these problems is the escalating cost of medical services and drugs, which are now largely out of reach for many who are looking elsewhere for relief. For VOA, Adi Gondo gives us more on the story from Bulawayo.
The cost of drugs is now out of reach for many who eke out an existence in a largely informalized economy, with figures standing at 90% of the labor force. This means that most Zimbabweans don't have medical aid and insurance. As the economy continues to struggle, many Zimbabweans are turning to traditional medicines. African history and traditional culture expert Patisa Nyati of the Amagugu International Center in the UNESCO World Heritage Area of Matopos National Park says traditional medicine has had a bad rap, partly as the residual effect of colonialism.
At the time of conquest, virtually everything African, especially if it was cultural, tended to be despised, denigrated, and demonized. Africans, by and large, were abandoning African medicine as an example, for example. But at the same time, they were abandoning everything African. Do note that there is a close link between African traditional religion and medicine. You can't remove one from the other.
In Nyati's view, economics is compelling Zimbabweans to reach back into their traditional culture.
We were moving away from African traditional medicine. But here we are in a very difficult economic situation. And people now have to look at African medicine with a different set of eyes. Study the lower echelons of society who get the hardest thing are finding difficult to afford medicine in our pharmacies.
A visit to M. Campbell in Bulawayo's Makokoba Township reveals the thriving trade in traditional herbs and concoctions which healers say can deal with all kinds of diseases, from STIs to cancer. Melody Ngwe, a 51-year-old traditional healer, runs one of the over 80 stores doing serious trade in African medicines. Speaking through her interpreter, she says they are helping many people and is quick to stress that sufferers should continue with conventional medicine, however.
People are coming, but they are facing challenges since the country has no money, there's economic hardships. But people should go to hospitals at the same time, come to traditional healers to seek assistance as well. People are coming in their numbers. We are advising them that they should not discontinue their medication prescribed by doctors from the hospitals.
Kogoma Ngwe, as she is called, says she treats cancers, piles, stomach issues and headaches with herbs she gets from the African bushveld. The likes of Gogoma Ngwe are regulated under the Traditional Medical Practitioners Act of 1981, which enables them to diagnose and treat patients. Still, the profession remains widely frowned upon because of attitudes fostered through the interaction with Christianity. Morgan Zimunya, an engineer by training, owns a traditional medicines brand called Msimboti, which can be found in local supermarket chains.
According to statistics we read or hear, it's about 80 or 90% of people in developing countries, Zimbabwe included, they use their traditional medicine. African medicine is not alternative. The reason why we're still into practice is because it's maybe 70% of our customers or patients, they come here through someone who has seen the benefit. So the efficacy can be ascertained.
Zimunya believes that commercializing African traditional medicines will help in demystification.
It says when African medicine is packaged and labeled, it's easier for people to market. So we encourage practitioners of African medicine to label and package their products. I would like to see more labeling and packaging of African medicines. And also I would like to see more visibility.
According to a World Health Organization report, 21 countries in the African region have developed legal frameworks that provide for accreditation and registration of traditional health practitioners, THPAs, and the establishment of a THP Council for regulation of traditional medical practice and products. Health experts say that non-regulation of traditional and herbal medicines poses a health risk. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You are hearing from Wizboy with 1+1 and Nyota Ndogo with Nibibi Follows. Then Maurice featuring Anita with Happy, Angelique Kidjo, Wombo Lombo. And then Diamond Platinums featuring Khadija Kopa ends with Nasema Nawi.
They make me the feel this way. In the ocean of your sweet love, maybe I'm swimming. True love, no be by energy. And see, I get the formula to penetrate your heart. Let me break it down. It's you that I want. The kind of ring when I won't give you. This time around, not that kind of ring though. When I go put on your finger, right on the altar. Baby, make me there. Make me the love. Oh, 1+1 is 1. Now, in be the the arithmetic, when go keep us together. Can nobody love you like I do, my baby. Oh, one plus one is one. Now it be the melody, I go to play you forever. Can nobody treat you like I do, my baby. Oh, baby. Take you out tonight for a dinner. Doing things right, like a man. Cause that I will be. See my baby, when I give me. Hey. I know they send anybody, even when the things they waste, but don't call you. Now then I go, they love you better, treat you well. No matter the weather, you go bomb my tata. It's the dream of every man to get a fine girl like you. We go be like priceless, you. Baby, me, I'm gonna make we the love.
Nitakuwa wa furaha, nipe tafadhali nikuonjeshe. ya manzi fulani wasema jua kali ananyesha baada ya kisoteso mna jua jota nisatesa pia mejaribu chunguza mvua gani inawaka nyota ndogo mkiangalia juu hewani inarushia kamba nivutia hapa chini kwa mchanga iwe yako msichana sitaki usiku ati mapenzi unionjeshe nipe yote ndamani kwa balkoni ndende na usishtuki ataka hapo nje tunaonekana na wasenge sababu letafanya kukupa penzi langu bebe itafanya wasenge wachana washitwa sichana wanze katika genge mwili zetu wawili zipate joto vile zimeshikana na mimi nakwambia tulia hapo ndani na mwaga pikana saka nitende mkoko chini za kichazia kijana hakuna mali naenda niko naye milele nimekubeba mkononi jo balkoni ongezeka kelele wananiwara mgongo kisema kuwa wakipenda maziwa kuwa ya nyesha
just be happy. Just be happy. kubatwa kikurunjinani majirani wote wamekuchoka bara chumba cha furani mtu gani wekwa kusoka washinda vifarasani ya wenzako kurukoka ukome mwana furani ona uso livyo kukumbuka tumisho vifaoni iko enye vikutoro usona haya usoni kote wazua mikogoro kivyo hauchioni kuwa una kasoro kuso mchana jioni sima juzi situmora tumisho vifaoni.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and engineer for today, Charleston Mark, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how beautiful and well-crafted a coffin might look, it will not make anyone wish for death. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.